slightly different from what I gave the organizers a while ago, but it's in the same spirit. First of all, I would like to thank the organizers of this conference for inviting me, but more importantly for inviting everybody else here, because I've really enjoyed the talks so far, and I'm looking forward to the rest of them. When Chris first emailed me and said, oh, we want to do this clock and quantum conference at Perimeter, will you give, be interested in giving a talk? I looked at the, it's okay if that goes away every once in a while, as long as, okay. I looked at the list of other people who were going to come and say, sure, yeah, I want to be there. And, oh yeah, by the way, I actually have been thinking about something to do with quantum and time, and so we actually do have a talk that sort of fits in with the theme of the conference. And so this is what I'm going to talk about. Start off with a quote that I think is familiar to most of you. I'm not going to read the whole thing. This is from Schrödinger's 1935 paper, which grew out of his reflections on the EPR paper. And this is a paper in which Schrödinger coined the word entanglement. And famously, Schrödinger said that he would call entanglement not one, but rather the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, the one that enforces this entire departure from classical lines of thought. And I think that there's something importantly true about that. And I find it interesting that 70 years later, we're still exploring consequences of entanglement. An awful lot of what quantum information people do is explore the consequences of quantum entanglement. What I want to talk about is consequences of quantum entanglement for quantum state evolution in a relativistic context. And when I say this, some of you are going to say, well, hey, wait. When I do relativistic quantum theory, it's usually a quantum field theory. And I usually don't talk about evolving states. I usually do everything in a Heisenberg picture or an interaction picture. And that's the right way to do it. OK, that may be true. But you can also, if you want to, and for some purposes, this may be a useful thing to do, pick a foliation of space-time, assuming you've got Minkowski space-time or some other globally hyperbolic space-time that admits of such a thing, and a time-like vector field, which is going to, whose integral curves are going to induce a same place relation between two points on two hypersurfaces, and in a way parallel to the way we go back and forth between the Heisenberg picture and Schrodinger picture of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, introduce a notion of an association of states with these space-like hypersurfaces and talk about evolving states in a relativistic context. And for some purposes, that might be useful. And you might call that a relativistic Schrodinger picture, or perhaps a better name might be the Tominaga-Schwinger picture. In the early days of quantum field theory, you occasionally saw in textbooks something called the Tominaga-Schwinger equation, which basically talked about evolving states from one hypersurface to another. It's not the common way of doing field theory these days. Okay, and what I want to do is look at relations between state histories given along different foliations. And feature of quantum mechanics that is going, or two features of quantum mechanics are that are going to be very relevant for all this is non-separability but locality. In Don Howard's writings on Einstein's thoughts on quantum mechanics, he distinguishes two very different principles that he finds in Einstein's thought, which at the time weren't always clearly distinguished. One is the principle of separability, and that's the claim that the state of affairs in each distinct spatial region can be specified independently of the state of affairs in any other. And once you've done that, once you've specified the state of affairs in every spatial region, that's everything there is to say about the world at that time. Einstein, in his 1948 Dialectica article, said explicitly, I think we should hold fast to this idea. And then another thing that Einstein thought that we should hold fast to is locality. Interactions are local. There's no instantaneous action at a distance. And the interesting thing about the quantum mechanical state's description, if you take it literally, if you think that in principle a quantum mechanical state description could be a complete one, then that state description violates separability. If you have space-like entanglement between two regions, then you can talk about the reduced state in this region, you can talk about the reduced state in that region, but once you've done that, you haven't said everything there is to say. The quantum mechanical state description does not satisfy the condition of locality, of separability, but as standardly conceived, it does satisfy locality. Interactions are local. If you've got two things, their coupling is local. If you're thinking these in terms of the adventures of Alice and Bob, and Alice and Bob share an entangled qubit, then the restriction on what they can do is what Alice's interactions with the pair are restricted to local ones. Okay. Now, why is this interesting? Well, it has consequences for quantum state evolution in a relativistic space-time. And the picture I like to use, because I want to look primarily at consequences of relativity of simultaneity, not having a unique instantaneous now. And I don't want to get too much into intricacies, complications involving quantum field theory, is put quantum mechanics, ordinary, plain, vanilla, non-relativistic quantum mechanics in a relativistic space-time. And of course, this can only be an approximation to what's really going on. But it's a useful approximation, and it works if you, say, have a finite number of quantum systems, each localized in disjoint distance regions of space. And so A and B are these systems. I've drawn their world tubes there. And I'm just going to look at segments of their history, joint histories, in which they're space-like separated from each other. And so what I've drawn is various space-like hypersurface there, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. Okay. And then given each one of those space-like hypersurfaces, I can talk about the state of the combined system on that hypersurface. And if these guys are evolving, then during this time from alpha and beta, there's going to be some evolution along A's world tube. It's going to be a local evolution. There's going to be some evolution on B's world tube. If A and B are isolated from their environments during this time, it's going to be a unitary evolution. If they're not isolated, then there's going to be some completely positive map that gives us the evolution from alpha to beta. And the crucial thing is the evolution, because these guys are space-like separated, and because we're imposing locality, the evolution has to be a product of some evolution of A and evolution of B. Okay. All right. The question I want to ask is, suppose all I know is the state on alpha and the state on beta. What's that going to tell me about the states on these other two hypersurfaces, gamma and delta? And I'm not assuming that I know what's going on in between. I'm not assuming that I already know the dynamics. Just give me those two states. Well, it tells you something, but the interesting thing is it doesn't always tell you everything. There's a special case in which it does tell you everything. That's the case when you don't have any entanglement. So if the state of A on alpha is some pure, say the combined system AB is a product of some kind of some pure states, and then And the same, and similarly on beta, then there's no other choice for the states on gamma and delta. It's just a matter of cut and paste. And that's how things work classically. If you give me the state history along some foliation, a complete state history along some foliation classically, because the classical state description is separable, then without any further ado, that'll give you state history along any other foliation. It's a matter of cut and paste. Now, something interesting happens when we've got entangled states. So suppose the state on alpha is some pure entangled state of A and B, and let's say there's a, and also on beta, so we've got some state vectors psi of alpha and psi of beta. Suppose we know what those are. That those by themselves aren't going to tell us what state vectors to associate with those other hypersurfaces. And here's a simple example. Suppose you have that. So you've got some local observable, I don't really care what it is, label two of its eigenstates as 0 and 1, and say you've got this state on alpha and that state on beta. And you say, well, how did it get there? Well, one way it could have gotten there, and perhaps the most obvious way, of course, is a bit flip happening at A and nothing happening at B. But if you think about it a moment, that's not the only thing that could have happened in between. There could have been a bit flip with a sign change at A and a compensating side change on B. Those two pairs of evolutions are going to lead to the same state on beta. And what they're not going to do, if I go to this hypersurface gamma, if you remember, gamma was the one that was the future of A, but still at the initial time on B. If I go to that state on gamma, so I'm only evolving A, I get different states depending on which one of these evolutions actually happened. And they are different states. The differences won't show up if I confine myself to measurements in the 0-1 basis, but they are states that lead to different predictions if Alice and Bob do measurements at those two points in a different basis. Now, when you see something like this, I think a natural question to ask, and by the way, part of my interest in this comes from the fact that David Albert has been going around giving talks about this sort of thing for the past few years. I thought about it a while back, and then didn't think about it for a while. And then David's been going around talking about it, and I've been discussing it with David, and some of you might have heard some of those talks. And some of you might have heard David give his own particular examples of these things and saying, well, okay, that's nice, but it's a special example. Does this generalize? Is this going to be the case much more generally, or is it or does it depend on very particular details of the example? So for instance, when people write down the simplest examples they think of, let me go back. They can think of, usually they write down states like this with same coefficients in front of each term. Does it depend on that? That sort of question. So one thing I want to ask is, how special are examples like these? And give a few results about this. The phrase that David Albert uses for this is non-narratability, but what he means by that is that a state history of the system along of this combined system given along one fungal foliation does not by itself, without adding anything else, uniquely determine the history along other foliations. And the motivation for that terminology, which I don't particularly like, but it seems to be gaining some currency in the profession, so maybe we're stuck with it. So you know, David is the one who first coined a term for it, so he probably gets to name it. The motivation from that is that what it means is that a complete moment-by-moment history of instantaneous states without mentioning the dynamics that leads from one state to another is not a complete account of what's going on. Now, that parenthetical remark is mine, and if David Albert were here, he probably would have told you what non-narratability is without that parenthetical remark. And I put that in because I say, well, perhaps it's not surprising. If you really want to say what's really going on, you have to say something about the dynamical laws that lead from one state to another. I'll talk about, towards the end, a little bit more about why David Albert finds this problematic. Okay. All right. A little bit of history. This sort of thing has been noticed various times in the literature. I first became aware of it from reading a paper by Aharonov and Albert in 1984. The title is from a series of papers that they wrote in Physical Review A. The title is something like, is the ordinary notion of time revolution adequate for quantum mechanics? And there's part one and two, and part two is relativistic considerations. And there they give a nice example of a... you've got a singlet state, and you've got apparatus that monitors the state. You've got apparatus that the two locations have to be entangled with each other, and it has this. And they point out that it only monitors the state without disrupting the state if the interactions of the system and the apparatus are turned on simultaneously, if they're in sync. And of course, that's not a relativistically invariant thing, whether or not these things are turned on simultaneously. And so what it does, if you look at its history along another foliation, is it the one that gets turned on first disrupts the state, and then by the end it's been put back together, And he says, and they say in that paper, the measuring process, so far as K is concerned, disrupts, as it were, the transformation properties of the state and disrupts its covariance without in any way disrupting the history of the state itself. I haven't talked to Yakir about this, but I do know that David Albert now regards that remark as a bit confused. Because when you're going from a state on one hypersurface to a state on another hypersurface, that's not just a Lorentz transformation or something like that. That's a matter of dynamical evolution, and you always have to consider dynamical evolution. The discussion there in that paper led to an impression that they thought that this sort of thing was confined to measuring processes and. In a paper I wrote, published in the Studies in History of Modern Philosophy, I more or less as it made a side remark that no, you can find this sort of thing all over the place. And I gave a simple example of a pair of particles in a singlet state. If you do nothing, the state doesn't change. On the other hand, if you switch on identical magnetic fields in both places lined up, then you get spin precession. But since each term is the product of plus and minus, the two spin precessions cancel each other out, and again, the state doesn't change. That fact that the state doesn't change will only be true in if you're looking at along a foliation in which those two magnetic fields are switched on simultaneously. Okay. All right. And then David Albert, I first heard him give a talk on this at a conference in Rutgers in 2005. He's got a paper, which I don't think he's published yet, but I think is on his website, called Physics and Narrative, if some of you want to look at that. Okay, so what I want to know is this special? You know, are we sort of cheating by cooking up very special examples? So the question I ask is, suppose I have these states, and I know there's some factorizable unitary relation between them. And the question is, will it always be the case that there are different ways to get from one to another? So the question is, are there going to be unitaries, U and UA and UB and U prime A and U prime B, that both get you from psi of alpha to psi of beta, but do something differently when you apply only one of them? And the answer follows from a theorem of Wojciech-Zurek about invariance. The question that I just asked on the other slide is equivalent to asking whether there's a product of unitaries that leave psi of alpha the same, but one of them, applying only one of them, does change it. And when you've got that, when you've got something like that, in Zurek's terminology, the state is invariant under that transformation. And the reason for that terminology is it's short for environmentally assisted invariance. And the idea is Alice can do something to the state that can be undone by something Bob can do. After the Rutgers conference in 2005, on the plane back, I worked out the answer to the question on how widespread this will be. And then a few months later, I was here and Zurek was giving a talk on invariance, and so I realized that what I had worked out on the plane was, in fact, already there in the literature in Zurek's paper. And so here's the theorem. And this is a very simple application of Zurek's theorem. If you want to know, if you have psi of alpha, psi of beta, and you want to know, and they're related by some product of unitaries, but you don't necessarily know which. And you want to know what are all the possible candidates for the states on these intermediate hypersurfaces, gamma and delta. Here's what you do. Write down a Schmidt representation of those two states. For those of you who are unfamiliar with that terminology, it's a bi-orthogonal representation. The AKs are all orthogonal to each other, as are the BKs. That can always be done. And when the coefficients CK are, I'm assuming those AKs and BKs are normalized. When the coefficients are all different in magnitude, those guys are determined up to a phase factor. When in the degenerate case, as in Bell states, there's some more leeway. So write down Schmidt representations. And it should be clear that psi gamma, as I write here, psi delta are, in fact, candidates. You can, in fact, write down unitaries that will get you from alpha to beta and have those effects for gamma and delta. So, I mean, the interesting thing is, I said, in the classical case, it's sort of cut and paste. Interestingly enough, it's in the quantum case, even though I've got a non-separable state description, it's a linear superposition of product states. And if I take a particular linear superposition of product states, namely the Schmidt representation, then I get to do the cut and paste then. And as a matter of, it turns out that you can prove that every candidate for states on gamma and delta are attainable that way from some Schmidt representations of the states psi of alpha and psi of beta. So that means that in the non-degenerate case, the leeway you have is in the relative phases of the Schmidt representation. And of course, that's the way my particular example worked. And you know that's that's been going to be the way. And you know, any example that anyone comes up with is going to work like this. And so if you're wondering about, if you're a little worried about me going back and forth between state history along a foliation, which of course is a continuous thing, to discretizing it saying alpha and beta. Well, if I give you state history continuously between alpha and beta, I can also always throw in continuously varying theta k's and give you different things along different foliations. Okay. All right. So the theorem is, for any pure entangled state, I can do this. It doesn't work for product states because what I'm doing is changing relative phases of terms in the Schmidt representation. And if I'm going to do that, I have to have more than one term in the Schmidt representation. If a product state, I have only one term. Okay. And so in the special case where I'm assuming that psi alpha and psi beta are pure, then it happens for any, this non-narratability happens for any entangled state. And there's a real sense in which the entangled states are most of them. You don't necessarily have to privilege any measure on the space of states. It's a topological thing. It's an open dense set. Take any entangled state. There's an open neighborhood of that entangled state consists entirely of entangled states. Take any product state. Every neighborhood of it's got entangled states in the norm topology. Now, if the systems aren't isolated, then it won't have unitary evolution, but I will have completely positive maps that give the evolution. And you can extend the theorem to those as long as the evolution is one that doesn't destroy phase information in the Schmidt basis, and that would disentangle the things. You can always find alternate maps that yield the same state history along F but differ along other foliations. And so once again, there's going to be an open dense set of initial pure state. Given any pair of any evolution, there's going to be an open dense set of initial pure states such that I could find alternate maps that give the same thing along one foliation and different things along other foliations. Okay. What happens, does it generalize? I'm talking about pure states of bipartite systems. What if they're entangled with something else? So their reduced state would be a mixed state. Or what if I go to larger systems? I have three or more quantum systems. Do I get the same kind of result? For those of you who heard me give a talk on this in Maryland back in April, I stuck to the bipartite pure state case and only later realized that something very interestingly different happens when you do the more general one. In the tripartite case, you can essentially extend the previous theorem that I had by first of all, treating it as a bipartite system, one whose component is A and another one is B and C together, write that in a Schmidt decomposition. So the A k's are orthogonal to each other, as are the phi k's. But Notice in the general case, the phi k's are going to be a entangled state of B and C. And so if I've got unitary evolution of the whole system, the triplet, and in the non-degenerate case, and that's a typical case, the only leeway I'm going to have is going to be in the relative phases of that Schmidt decomposition. And if I'm going to implement that for different theta k's, that means that the phi k, and I'm going to implement that locally, so local evolution of A, local evolution of B, and local evolution of C, that means the phi k's have to be locally, you know, there has to be a pair of the phi k's, at least, that are locally distinguishable. I.e., there's something that Bob can do to distinguish those two states, and there's something that Clara can do, or there's something that Clara can do to distinguish those tapes. And that's not going to be typical. That's going to be a very special set of states. That's going to be the states essentially when the phi k's share the same Schmidt basis. And if I've got a case like that in which that's satisfied, I can just perturb it a bit and turn it into a case where it's not. So interestingly enough, as soon as I go to the this kind of case, I no longer have for the typical initial states of the tripartite system that I get to cook up different evolutions that give different that give different things along different foliations. Essentially, the evolution along one foliation determines it on another one for most in the sense of an open norm dense set of pure states of A, B, C. Another way of thinking about this, if you start with the bipartite system in a mixed state, perhaps because it's entangled with C or something else, we can always write that in as a mixture of mutually orthogonal states. And if the system AB is undergoing unitary evolution, it's going to leave each one of those states pure and mutually orthogonal. And then essentially what I'm doing is I'm applying the theorem to each one of those pure states. And if I'm going to have something that leaves them all, you know, I can reduce it to the Zurek invariance case where the evolution from alpha to beta leaves the thing invariant. Well, it's going to have to leave in a non-degenerate case where those WKs are all different. The only way to leave that state invariant is to leave all of its components invariant. The only way to do that by factorizable unitary evolutions is to have evolutions that commute with the Schmidt basis, and that'll only do it for all of them if they share a common Schmidt basis. And for typical mixed states of A and B, that won't be the case. Okay, that's what I just said. So, that's what I just said. I would like to I was talking about unitary evolution of the tripartite system or the mixed state. I would have liked to be able to say yes, and it generalizes it to factorizable non-unitary evolution where you've got completely positive maps. I do believe that it does generalize, but what I haven't got is the proof all worked out in the details. So it's possible that there's a surprise there but I don't think there will be. Okay. Now, what does this mean for the issue, does quantum state evolution satisfy meritability in David Albert's sense, or does it not? Well, I think what it does is it requires us to make a distinction between two claims of meritability you might want to make. And so I suggest terminology that we distinguish between strong narratability, and that would be the claim that a state history along one foliation uniquely determines the state history along any other foliation without any consideration of what kind of the dynamics at all, versus what we're getting in for typical initial states of these tripartite systems is it's a case of the state history along one foliation, that says with, but it should say one, together with the constraint that the evolution is some local evolution, not, but you're not necessarily saying which, permitted by the theory, uniquely determines the state history along any other foliation. In quantum mechanics, only state histories consisting of pure product states satisfy the strong narratability constraint, but typical mixed states, pure entangled states of a bipartite system violate both of them, and that's the special case in which most of the examples that are in the literature so far fall into, including the ones I've given, and I think we should apologize for that, because it's different when you go outside that special case. Generic mixed state of a bipartite system and generic states of tripartite or larger systems undergoing unitary evolution violate the strong narratability condition but satisfy the weak narratability condition. And I think it generalizes to non-unitary evolution too. Okay. Now another interesting question. So I think that that's just a distinction that is going to have to be observed as people go on and talk about what, if any, foundational significance there is to this. Another thing I find an interesting question is whether this is a uniquely quantum kind of thing. And you may say, well, of course it is, because it depends on non-separability. And classical state descriptions satisfy separability. Well, for that reason, I think that it is useful to look at other theories that are non-classical and non-quantum, sometimes artificially constructed, and ask if in those kinds of theories do we get non-narratability anytime we've got non-separability. And the sort of thing I have in mind is exemplified, say, by Rob Speckin's toy theory. Some of you may know that. What it is, it's an essentially classical theory with restrictions on state preparation and measurement. And what it is there's four boxes. And there's a ball that can be in one of those boxes. And the constraint imposed, the way I would put it, is the probability of it being in any one of those boxes can't be greater than 1/2. And then there's a constraint on measurements, which is you can't open a single box and say, is the ball in there? But you can take any pair of boxes. If you can take any pair of boxes and ask, is the ball in one of those? I don't pretend that these are anything except artificial ad hoc constraints, but I do think that they're interesting. So we can call the pure states of that theory the extremal states of that theory, the states that are not mixtures of anything else permitted by the theory. And then you can have a pair of such systems, and you can give rules for the states of those, and end up with entangled states, which would mean pure states, pure states of the theory, i.e., states are not mixtures of any other state allowed by the theory, which nevertheless are entangled in the sense of having mixed marginals. And one of the And so um, what's Beckens permits is things like this. If this is, you know, one set of boxes and this set of boxes, it would be something where there's an equal probability that ball A and ball B are in their respective box one, or they're both in their box respective box two, et cetera. So that would count as an entangled state of that theory. Now, the reason I find these kinds of toy models interesting is my take on it, and this is not Rob Speckin's take, is that if we can reproduce some feature of quantum mechanics via a theory like this, that's not where we should look for the deep differences between quantum and classical. And I realize that that's a very different attitude from that Rob Speckens has, and probably a lot of the people in the room, because he one of the neat things he does is showing a great deal of detail that a lot of things that you might think of as uniquely quantum can be reproduced in a theory like this. And the picture he wants to push for, I think, is an epistemic view of the quantum state. He wants us to think of quantum states as more like classical mixed states than we traditionally do. So the question I want to ask is, is it going to be the case that any theory that contains entangled states is also going to exhibit this phenomenon that Albert calls non-narratability? And the answer is with a mild side constraint, yes, it will. So just imagine I've got some kind of theory. And A has two isomorphic subsystems, A1 and A2, and so does B. And let's suppose that our theory has some kind of entangled state in it. And let A1 and B1 be in that entangled state, and let A2 and B2 be in the corresponding entangled state. And I have to say something about what kind of transformations are allowed. Suppose that any local automorphism of the state faces are physically possible transformations, and what all I care about really is that a swap is, so something that swaps the contents of A1 and A2, or it swaps the contents of B1 and B2. So, you can cook up. So, here's. For any such theory, there will be things that you can do on the A side that can be undone on the B side. So it's going to be something that is just a consequence of having non-separable states in the theory, plus some kind of transformations that you can do on one side. Obviously, if you have a theory with no transformations, then it's a boring theory and you can't do anything. Interesting question is, for which theories will we have this kind of invariance for all pure entangled states? I would like to be able to write down a nice condition that is a sufficient condition for that. I don't really know how to do it, but if you want to come up with counterexamples, a necessary condition is that there are local transformations that change the state but leave the marginals invariant. So if you want to come up with a theory in which you can't do that, just artificially cook up one in which that fails. Okay, and I'm going to skip that because I'm running out of time. I'm very close to my time being out, I think. Yes? I want to quit with time for discussion. Okay, I'm going to stop here with a question. More of a question to the audience, I think, because we've got this. Is there? I'm not sure whether I want to say that this is just a consequence of non-separability applied to relativistic quantum relativistic state evolution, and it's just another way of talking about non-separability. And once you accept we've got a non-separable state description, none of this is going to be surprising. So that's one way of looking at it. Another thing is, no, this is something interesting and new when you go to the relativistic case. And I mean, one thing it does mean is that if you actually do decide to look at state evolution in a relativistic context, it's going to have, because of the non-separability of quantum mechanics, it's going to have some features unfamiliar from the classical context. Not necessarily paradoxical or objectionable, just unfamiliar if you're used to classical stuff. Now, part of the reason that David Albert's interested in this is because he wants to defend a view which is also was also defended by the late David Lewis, and Lewis called it human supervenience, that everything that happens can be reduced to a sequence of instantaneous snapshots of the state of the world, and that the dynamical laws are mere summaries of general features of this state history. And this sort of thing spells trouble for that view. And the lesson that I draw from this, which is not the lesson that David Albert would like to draw from this, is that we should be realist about dynamics. There is, if I've got a pair of spin 1/2 particles, there's a real difference between nothing happening to those guys and them precessing in opposite directions. Even if it doesn't show up in a state history given along a certain foliation, there is something different going on in those two cases. So that's the lesson that I would draw. And if you think that that's the lesson to be drawn, then one way to think about it, there was a remark made by David Deutsch at the Oxford Everett conference last summer in response to David Albert talking about this thing. And at the time he made it, I didn't really understand it. And so I'm not absolutely sure that, but then I went away and thought about it for a little bit. And this is what I got from it, and I'm not absolutely certain that it's what David Deutsch intended to say, but is that, because he did say, this shows the superiority of the Heisenberg picture. It gives a clear picture of what's going on. And I asked myself, well, what did he mean by that? Well, one thing one could mean by that is that if I do all this in the Heisenberg picture, those two different evolutions are going to give you different Heisenberg operators as they evolve. So in the spin precession case, you've either got nothing happening, so you've got, suppose you've got a magnetic field in the z direction, you've either got nothing happening to any of your spin operators, or nothing happened to the z, but the sigma x's and sigma y, rotation in the sigma x in the xy plane. And the reason that that doesn't show up in the states is that those differing Heisenberg picture operators in that particular state all have zero expectation value. Or the differences between them have zero expectation value. But if the way you represent what's going on is Heisenberg's picture state without putting the time evolution in the Heisenberg picture state and put the time evolution in the operators, then you do get, depending on which evolution is going, you get different Heisenberg pictures operators. So one consequence that someone might draw is, okay, if I want to get a clear picture of what's going on in the relativistic context, yay for the Heisenberg picture. I'm going to stop there and take questions and comments.
Hi. I have two questions, quick questions. One is, how does this formalism, okay, so you have a relativistic picture here.
Yeah.
How do predictions made in this formalism differ, if at all, from if you formulated the same problem in field theoretic context? And the other is, what happens if you put curvature into this?
Yeah, so what I said is, even if you think that the real picture is a field theoretical picture, you should be able to do this sort of thing as an approximation. And so to the extent that I can ignore issues of localization of particles and stuff like that, this will be valid. And this isn't meant to be an alternative to a field theoretical picture. This is just a useful way of doing the same quantum mechanics that will be valid for certain approximations. So the answer is no. I don't think. I just think this is another different way of talking about the same thing. I'm sorry. What was the second question?
What happens if you put curvature in?
What happens if you put curvature in? I don't think the little thing I said at the beginning. I said, take some hypersurfaces. So I'm assuming you've got a fixed background, globally hyperbolic space-time. Give a tight time-like vector field whose integral curves let you identify points on different surfaces in that foliation, and then whatever field theoretic picture you've got in your curve space-time, you can translate into this picture.
We're running fairly short of time, and we've got several questions in the queue, so I'd like to encourage people to make the question short.
What is, from a classical point of view, the kind of systems where, like in the paper, period three implies chaos, does narratability say that where you have something, snapshots are not sufficient to predict the future dynamics of the present in a highly chaotic system? So is that an example of of narratability versus non-narratability? And what does Ehrenfest's theorem say about narratability, non-narratability?
Okay, so the question wasn't whether an instantaneous snapshot at one time plus the dynamics determines the state at other times. That's the question that's being asked when you're asking questions about chaotic dynamics and things like that. And actually, the question being asked when you're asking something is chaotic or not is whether there a coarse grain snapshot at one time tells you much interesting about what the state at a later time. Because when people are studying chaotic dynamics, it is nevertheless deterministic chaotic dynamics. It is the case that the initial state determines, plus the dynamics determines any other states. It's just that you have this very sensitive dependence on initial conditions. So finite information about the initial state quickly becomes useless. So that kind of issue is sort of orthogonal to the sorts of questions that I'm talking about here.
Liv?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are very short.
Yeah, we can talk
time.
More.
Yeah. Liv?
In July, I saw Dave Albert, and he brought me kind of similar puzzle. Alice and Bob have two EPR pairs,
right?
And in particular moment, they make locally swap the states of their local particles. Mm-hmm. Then in this frame, we have two EPR pairs from minus infinity to plus infinity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clearly is not a whole, does not tell us the whole story, because in another Lorentz frame, both different particles became entangled.
Right.
And he was pretty happy with my answer to this narratability kind of puzzle or approach. Sure. First, of course, there is an approach that if you take your quantum state plus Hamiltonian, then everything is fine. And second, since even in one Lorentz frame, the quantum state doesn't tell you what will happen when you make non-local measurement in space and time, clearly you have to add this information. if in one Lorentz frame you will add all the information about all probability in all possible space-time measurements, then everything is narratable and you don't have to introduce dynamics.
Yes, I agree with everything that you just said. And notice I didn't present this as a paradox because I don't find it paradoxical. The way I described it is something that would be unfamiliar from expectations from a classical context. But is it paradoxical? No, I don't think so.
Yeah, I have two brief comments. One is just to agree with this kind of the implication of what Rev said, which is, although he probably wouldn't accept the way I would say it, which is that really one needs a space-time viewpoint rather than a purely stated a moment of time. And something like a history is a much better way to think about quantum mechanics than a succession of states.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing I wanted to throw out, it's a possible example of non-separability,
yes,
even in a purely classical theory. I've always felt a little confused about this, but maybe I'll just throw it out for you or someone to respond to, which is in general relativity. Topological features are in some sense non-separable. So even metric features can do the same thing, but topological features are perhaps easier to see. The difference between a strip of paper that's a band with a twist and without a twist, in other words, like a cylinder in a Möbius strip, is that a separable thing or not? I mean, if I look at any local region, it's exactly the same, and yet globally the two are different. And if we embed this, say, in a Kaluza-Klein model, this can actually be a difference, a global difference in a gauge field that has apparently no local, purely local, or it's not built up out of purely local facts.
I'd like to thank you for that question. When people talk about non-separability, they usually just assume a background space-time, which is either Galilean space-time or Minkowski space-time, and they don't think about questions like whether statements about the global topology are reducible to statement, compendium of local things. And of course, it's absolutely right that statements about global topology are not reducible to statements about local things. And that is obscured by the way the discussion tends to go, which you just assume a background space-time, usually with an uninteresting topology. So I think, yes, you're right. And that's an interesting thing to point out. And I might have more to say about that after I've thought more about it.
One more quick question, Richard.
Yeah. You said that, at least Albert, and I think you, take it that the view that everything that happens can be reduced to a sequence of instantaneous snapshots is threatened by what you've presented to us, and that gave us a reason for believing in dynamics as well.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just enrich the set of snapshots to include snapshots in every foliation? Then you've got the dynamics too.
Yes, okay. On the way over here, it occurred to me that I should probably add a line to that slide, which includes a qualification which could be... Harvey, I think, had a quote in his talk, Bell's dictum, that actually was, I don't remember who was Harvey or John, but someone had a quote up from Bell saying, the physics in one reference frame should tell you about physics in another reference frame. And if you associate with a reference frame, a certain foliation and state-by-state things, then, so what is threatened is human supervenience plus the idea that a state history given by one reference frame's time coordinates should tell you everything. And yeah, what you mentioned there has occurred to me also. One way out for the defender of human supervenience is just to say, expand the instantaneous snapshots to mean, on a full on instantaneous snapshots on a rich set of hypersurfaces. So yes, so it's a combination of human supervenience plus the idea that the story along one foliation should tell you everything.
Very briefly, even if you enrich the set of snapshots, it wouldn't give Lewis's human supervenience because he wanted everything to be local.
It wouldn't be Lewis supervenience.
No.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wayne.
Right.